Well, now, my first guest this Saturday morning is the world-renowned brain health expert, clinical neuroscientist and pioneer in dementia research, Professor Vladimir Hachinsky. He's the recipient of the 2024 Ryman Prize, which is an annual $250,000 grant for the world's best discovery, development, advance or achievement that enhances quality of life for older people. It's celebrating the major contribution Professor Hachinsky has made to the diagnosis, treatment, prevention and the links between what's called the terrible three, stroke, dementia and coronary heart disease. Professor Hachinsky advocates for prevention by promoting the idea of holistic brain health, linking cerebral health with mental health and social health, so the ability to interact and form meaningful relationships with others. Alongside New Zealand-based dementia educator Caroline Bartle, I asked Professor Hachinsky why it is said we should treat our brain like an expensive car.
First of all, the human brain is the three most precious pounds in the known universe. It's unmatched by flexibility, creativity, and even durability. And we each have one, but it's vulnerable and irreplaceable. So if you had a car that was worth millions and millions and millions, I think you take very good care of it. So I think that's the analogy.
And so if that is the case, if we have to look after our brains, what kinds of things do we need to do for that kind of holistic brain health, which will be helpful and protective against dementia, but also against other conditions that people could suffer?
That's exactly right. Now, let me give you, there is a comprehensive definition by WHO, but it's rather complex. And so we have produced a sort of a WHO-inspired version of it. And it is when you're thinking, you're feeling, and you're connecting with others, is at its best in a safe, healthy, supportive environment. Now, clearly for the individual, we need to focus on what is brain health for me. And we are working to develop something that's so simple that most people can follow part of it. We're calling it the ABC. And it stands for A is activity and sleep, B is a balanced diet and blood pressure control, and the third one is connecting with others. Now, the amount that it takes in each of them to make a difference is really small. For example, in exercise, the key word is move. You know, the biggest benefit is getting up and getting around. You already get the benefit. If you manage to walk 3,000 steps a day, you decrease the risks of dying early. And if you manage 3,800 steps, the risk of dementia is diminished. If you do it with someone else, you double the chances that you will continue to do it. And if you do it in greenery, you get an additional benefit in decreased anxiety levels, decreased stress, decreased blood pressure, and decreased heart rate. And in fact, the Japanese showed this to be effective years ago, and they even have a word for it, Shirin Yoku, which means forest bathing. So similarly, we have a suggestion, what's the basics for sleep, etc. And the basic idea is, what's the least that gives me the most? And one thing that I do want to emphasize, I don't want to go over them, I want you to give you a chance to ask me the specific questions, but the one I want to emphasize is blood pressure control. It turns out that most of us will develop high blood pressure somewhere along the line. 82% of people will develop it. And the interesting thing is that it already comes on at age 46, give or take 15 years. And the interesting thing is that only half the people who have high blood pressure know that they have it or have it well controlled. So we have a huge opportunity of really tackling the single most powerful predictor of risk in stroke, heart disease, and dementia. And everywhere in the world, high blood pressure can be diagnosed and also can be treated because there are effective drugs, affordable, that are available even in the lowest income countries.
So from this, it seems that there are quite simple, straightforward, hopefully in part fairly reasonably priced ways that we can tackle dementia.
Right.
I guess a lot of people perhaps think that there's an inevitability to dementia, that it is part of the natural aging process. You say no?
No, that's a very good question. I get asked that often. And most people believe that, by the way, and the trouble is that some of the health professionals also believe it, and it's not true. I'll give you some statistics. When people are in their 70s, 5% of them will have dementia. In people in their 80s, 24% will have dementia. By the time they're 90 and beyond, then 37% of dementia. But at all stages of life, the chances of keeping your mental abilities are greater than developing dementias. But however, we are not satisfied. We have to do better. We need to expand not only the lifespan, but the brain span. And that's the focus of our efforts.
And not all dementias are created equal. Talk me through some of the perhaps most commonly seen ones.
Yes. Well, first of all, dementia is a syndrome. It's not a disease. And Alzheimer's disease, the typical case diagnosed as Alzheimer's disease, has up to 8 different causes, among which the only treatable and preventable so far is the vascular one. In other words, the blood vessel part. So no one drug is going to stop progression of dementia, because most elderly people who have dementia have a mixture, some of it treatable, some of it preventable.
And because there is no silver bullet for many of the dementias that are out there, this is why we need to take a different approach. We actually need to go for that further back,
brain
more
health.
Holistic, exactly. Brain health view.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And there's another point why we cannot afford just to focus when people develop symptoms. And that is that let's imagine that there was a silver bullet and we stopped all the people who have cognitive impairment from progressing to dementia. But the next year, there'll be another group, a larger group, that has cognitive impairment because of the aging population. We'll never catch up. So the idea is that doing small things in a large number amounts to a big impact. I'll give you an example. For example, blood pressure control. 2 millimeters of systolic blood pressure, the top one, decrease, is about the first meaningful change clinically. If you're able to do that at population level, you decrease the chances of stroke by 24%. A stroke doubles the chances of developing dementia. So all of a sudden, by that single activity, you're decreasing the risk of the terrible three, I call terrible three, that's dementia, heart disease, and stroke. So we have the power to make a difference.
The difficulty, though, is that we have the power, presumably, to make the difference when we're not probably thinking about these kinds of things much earlier on in life.
No, we are not. We are not. We are not. And we're putting too much onus on the individual. I think it has to be done not just at individual level, but it has to be done in actionable units. By this, I mean a group small enough that it has a sense of community. And the study we are proposing, we're first of all identifying people who are undergoing change. So we're doing two things, well, three things, really. The first one is identifying individuals who are undergoing change, like people going to retire, like people who are new employees, and expecting mothers. Those are huge changes for each, and then we're open to change. Secondly, we're doing in the first instance with organizations that have as their mandate brain health, and that is hospitals and clinical practices. And then thirdly, we're developing the ABC that I mentioned to make it so simple that most people can do something. And I'm quite optimistic that if you focus on the group and also make sure that it isn't only the employees but their partners, and we have the agreement of the hospitals that they're willing to have partners undergo the same management, for example, if they require high blood pressure, they'll get it treated, will almost certainly will show in a very short time a positive impact. And then, of course, once we show that it works, we'll extend it to the hospitals, to any employee. And one of the great pleasures and privileges of getting the Ryman Award is it gives us a platform to encourage others to take similar approaches so that we get there faster. Because if we're doing something that, as far as I'm aware, has not been attempted, and so if we're a number of us in different countries trying to achieve the same thing, we'll get much further faster. As you know, there is an African saying, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you're going to go far, go with others. We like to go with others, including collaborators in New Zealand.
And to that point, Caroline, I would like to bring you in at this point. You are listening to Saturday Morning on RNZ National with Susie Ferguson. My guests are Professor Vladimir Hachinsky and also Caroline Bartle. Caroline, you work in dementia, or having that particularly as a focus of your work here in New Zealand. How does this approach that we've been hearing about, how does that land here? Does it mesh in with the sorts of opportunities and the sorts of things that we're looking at here in Aotearoa?
Definitely. I mean, it's been part of policy for many years, in fact, almost a decade since it was first mentioned in policy. And it's part of, it's a priority in the Dementia Mati Wari Wari Action Plan. But there are, as Vladimir said, things that we need to do as a whole systems approach in order to make these work. And one of the things is making sure that our workforce is skilled enough and understand risk reduction in dementia. You know, working as a caregiver, not necessarily primary health, but working as a caregiver going into people in terms of home-based support, they might start to see early signs of dementia, or they might be signs of that there are risk factors. We know that there are 12 modifiable risk factors for dementia, and the report that was published by the Lancet Commission suggested that some of those risk factors are more modifiable at specific points in your life. So we know that after the age of 65, certain risk factors are still modifiable, even smoking, for example, which was quite a surprise. And many people don't know that hearing loss, for example, is a modifiable risk factor under the age of 65. And in New Zealand, we have a very culturally diverse and rich population. And we also know that risk factors are different for different cultural groups. So part of what we need to do in New Zealand is make sure that our interventions are tailored to meet the different needs of our community.
Just before you go on and tell us a little bit about some of that, when you say something is a modifiable risk factor, what are you meaning?
OK, so some factors are not modifiable. We can have genetic risk factors. APOE4 is a high risk factor. If you have both from two parents, you're at high risk of developing Alzheimer's type dementia. If you're a woman, you're much more at risk of developing dementia. And that's because it's not because we have to live with men. It's because we live much longer. And, you know, arguably there's a lot more stress in our lives, often having to juggle many different things. Those things are not modifiable. But then there are factors that are modifiable, and these are to do with the lifestyle factors. And this links into what Vladimir was saying earlier about the brain health optimization model. These are things that we can do something about. But actually being able to do something about them and changing lifelong behaviours are two very distinct and different things. So it does take a very skilled approach. It isn't just about telling somebody to suddenly stop smoking, or to say to somebody, well, look, you've got depression, because depression is actually a modifiable risk factor. You know, sort yourself out. You know, there are things that we, systems and processes that we need to put around it to make sure that people are properly supported in a timely way.
So what sorts of approaches do we have? You mentioned the Wari Wari Action Plan. What kinds of things are we utilising, and what are you talking about with that?
Well, there are three levels to risk reduction. I like to call them primary, secondary and tertiary risk reduction. And at tertiary risk reduction, what we're talking about is once somebody actually has dementia, the approaches that we would use to alleviate the symptoms, you know, that's primarily is my role, is to try and put strategies and therapeutic interventions in place so that we can minimise the cognitive decline that people experience. And then you've got secondary level prevention is when somebody starts to notice that there's something wrong with their memory. And it might be subjective or it might have been diagnosed as a mild cognitive impairment. But we, you know, specific strategies around cognitive stimulation, you know, brain training, all of those ones also that Vladimir mentioned, you know, exercise is really good. And, you know, we have a lot of those kinds of services, but we need to try and develop those across the whole country and be able so that they're accessible to everybody.
And in what way is it a culturally appropriate approach that you have?
Well, it's a personalised risk assessment is part of the process. We know that research suggests to us that multimodal interventions work best. So that means doing many different things at once. And that's probably because we know there are multiple different causes for dementia. Most pathologies are mixed pathologies. But so we need to have, first of all, an approach where we can almost like risk assess people, understand what their cultural needs are, understand what their health needs are, and then be able to intervene in a very personalised, targeted way, because that way we're likely to have much more of an impact. But those things require skills, and our workforce requires skills development. I've come from the UK only a year and a half ago, and there we've been working to bring risk reduction training to the masses in terms of the care workforce. So it's just really getting people to understand what the risk factors are, how you undertake risk assessment, and how you refer to allied health colleagues.
So specifically, what is the worry-worry approach you take?
Well, the Dementia Multi Worry Worry Action Plan, are you talking about, is broad, and it's got such fantastic momentum. There's a leadership group that's coordinating it. It's got a really great participation with family and whānau and people with lived experience. And, you know, having just come to I've been backwards and forwards to New Zealand for years, and having moved here at this point, it's such an exciting time because things are really starting to happen in the dementia space in New Zealand now. So there's a lot of learning and connecting and talking to each other. What's the best way to do the things that we need to do with essentially limited resources that the country has? Mm. You know, what's the best we can do with what we've got?
What do we do well in New Zealand in dementia care?
Well, there's it's a Māori health model, and it's fantastic because it fits dementia care like a glove. You know, it's all about the importance of our roots, the four pillars, which very much links in with what Vladimir was talking about, brain health. It's about the importance of community, family, whānau. You know, there's so much that we can learn from those ways of thinking because it's exactly aligned to what we need in dementia care.
Is this the Te Whare Tapa Whā?
Thank you.
Yeah, okay. Yes. So you're talking about the Te Whare Tapa Whā approach and that sort of way of looking at dementia care. That's probably quite revolutionary, I suppose, in some ways to the way that it has perhaps been viewed in the past.
Yeah, well, we know that good dementia care is all about, you know, people connecting with others. There's a concept called the disappearing world, which we hear about a lot in dementia, where people's circle of friends gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And actually, they've researched this and people's actual footprint gets smaller and smaller and smaller. So actually being connected to communities, having purpose and actually having control. Control is a huge part of it. You know, in many cultures, older people have more control. But, you know, the problem with a lot of our Western communities is that age isn't seen very positively, and that can impact negatively. And, you know, I think the assets that we have in our community in terms of brain wealth, you know, we have people that retire but actually have huge untapped contribution to society. And actually, so it's not just about protecting people against dementia, it's about optimising brain health so we can leverage that potential.
Professor Haczynski, to come back to you on this, I'm interested that women are more likely to develop dementia. What is your understanding of why that is? Is it simply because women tend to live longer, or is there something else going on with our brains and potentially, I suppose, with the interplay with hormonal changes around menopause?
Well, first of all, I don't know the answer. I'm not sure that the answer is known. But it is not simply because they live longer. There's something about being a woman, especially after menopause. And it's really very complex. It is multifactorial, and it isn't simply the fact that they live longer.
Okay. Dementia, though, is declining per cases per 1,000 of population. It is declining in some countries, but it remains stubbornly high in others. Is it clear why that is happening?
No, but I think I have some statistics, new statistics that we just gathered for New Zealand. The rate of stroke, the rate of ischemic heart disease has declined in New Zealand over the past 30 years. Dementia hasn't budged. And it's worse than that, because not only has it not budged, like, in other words, the chances of getting at a particular age have not changed from 30 years ago, but because the population is aging, there are more cases of dementia, and there will be more cases of dementia, because the phenomenon that I'm calling yogi has nothing to do with yoga or with gurus. It's simply the young, old, growing imbalance. So the life expectancy in New Zealand is now 83 years, and the birth rate is 1.8. Now, to keep the population level, you have to have an average of 2.1 children per woman. So clearly, unless there is a radical change, there will be an increasing number of older people. And this yogi phenomenon is the fact that more people are getting old than being born. But to answer your more general question, are there countries in the world where there is a decline? And the answer is yes. In fact, our own project that we're doing now is based on our observation that in the province of Ontario, of 14 million inhabitants, that over a 12-year period, the incidence, the cases per 1,000, have declined by 7%. If you multiply that by the population of 14 million, you're talking about tens of thousands of people who didn't get dementia. Mm. So what are we doing right? Now, we doctors and medical professionals will claim, of course, credit. But it turns out that in Canada, 10% of health is due to environment. 40% is due genetics, biology, and all the things that medical professionals do. And 50% are due to socioeconomic factors. So we put a team together from five faculties looking at environment, we're looking at social factor, individual factors, and we're trying to find out what is it that we're doing right. So there are possibilities. In some countries it's happening, but it has not happened in New Zealand. It ought to happen. It can happen.
I'm interested in, you know, using a province of part of Canada, because Canada has such diverse populations, Indigenous people. I mean, clearly it's much bigger than New Zealand. But what sorts of things do we have to take into account when we think about all the different parts of the population? Because clearly there are some who have much more access to some of, you know, aspects of healthcare than others. There are some who will be working three jobs, so they may be less able to pick up on your ABC and get enough sleep and that kind of thing.
That's exactly right. And one of the reasons that we're beginning with hospitals is that The hospitals, in some ways, are representative of the larger society. In other words, they have people who work in the cafeteria, in the physical plant, who are low income. Then we have intermediate people, the clerks and the people who do administration. And then you have the professional staff. And in addition, in the project that we're proposing, we will be including family practices that include Aborigines. And as you say, we do have a sizable minority, including in my area of London, Ontario, of what, as we call them in Canada, First Nations. And yes, there are differences. And we want to reach out to them. We're not awaiting them. Access to care is not a major problem in Canada. We do have a healthcare system so that people can access it. It's the awareness of accessing it and also doing the things that are available already that are not being taken advantage of. I'm back to the ABC of brain health, you know, and I've repeated because I just said it once, and that is activity and sleep, a balanced diet. And here the key word is exchange. Don't ask the sort of person who's doing three jobs to switch to a healthy diet that is expensive. So the nutritionist we're working with says, let's meet them where they're at. In other words, if they're eating unhealthy 7 days a week, well, maybe one of those days they can exchange it for something. And so be happy whatever they can change. And then the third one is connecting with others. We didn't realize before how important that is. The pandemic showed us isolation can be devastating. If you are isolated, you have an increased chance of developing heart disease by 24%. If you are isolated, you have a 37% chance of developing a stroke. And if you're isolated, you have a 50% increased risk of developing dementia. And we now know that isolation physically shrinks your brain. So the ability to interact with others, the fact that you have a sense of community, is just as important as eating healthy or even being active.
Mm. And of course, you mentioned this was something that came into quite sharp focus in the pandemic. Social connection, does it have to be in person, or can it be social connection over Zoom? Can it be social connection on the phone? Can it be writing emails to each other? Where does that start and stop?
All of the above. And in fact, there was an interesting study done in Framingham in the United States in which they showed the power of networks. For example, if I quit smoking, there's a 50% chance that my friend will stop smoking. And there's a 20% chance that my friends will stop smoking, and so on. So if you have a good habit, and then you have this sense of community that I'm talking about the actionable units, you can really multiply the benefit. And then the other, there are some good news despite all the statistics, and that is that if we resolve to do something, it doesn't take that many people to begin to change. And it has been calculated that if 10% of the population changes the mindset, then change follows very quickly. And let's face it, all innovations have been initiated by minorities. So someone has to start it. And we hope that this great opportunity you offer me to talk to others, to begin doing something, will sort of start the idea that we have to do more, that this is not good enough, and that we can and we ought to.
What are some of those early signs that people should be aware of when it comes to dementia?
It isn't that you cannot remember names, okay? Let's start with that. We have a totally, unrealistic expectation for our memory, and that is that we think that, you know, we test it every day. For example, if you didn't know about a sport event, or if you didn't know about what's happening in the news, they would look at you and look at many people we meet. So there are reasons why when we get older, we don't remember as well. The first one is that the brain itself doesn't work as fast. But as I'm fond of saying, as people get older, they can't walk as fast. They cannot think as fast, but they often can think better. And so one reason is simply the machinery is not that quick. And secondly, you have a huge experience. You know, if you're 25, you haven't lived that much. If you're 75, I mean, all the memories that you have, and there's a phenomenon in psychology called interference. If you know something that's similar, it's hard to recall that. So going back to your question, what are the signs? Well, change in behavior as well, judgment, executive function. That's something that is underestimated. The ability to plan, the ability to foresee, et cetera, et cetera. So I think any change, well, memory, of course, can also be a symptom, but it has to be severe. And there is the aha test. If I forget my keys and then I find them, I say, aha, I found them. You're okay. If you look at the keys and have no idea where you placed them, that is an important sign.
Can people be personally aware if they are developing dementia?
That's quite variable. Depends what they do. If they do a job and they cannot do it as well, they'd be aware. But if not doing a job and their daily life is not very demanding, they might not be. Mm. In fact, they might deny it.
And the actual experience of early dementia, do we know what that is like to go through?
Well, I think there are some, in addition to what Vladimir was saying, there are some other very early indicators. Loss of smell can be one. Loss of weight can be another. There are a multitude of early indicators that are often missed. And then there are situations where people are younger that develop dementia, but because they're younger, it's missed because we don't expect younger people to develop dementia. In terms of the experience of what it must be like, I think it's very important to hear the lived voice, experience of people that are living with dementia. They're the best people to tell you what it must be like. I'm sure it's an incredibly frightening experience, I'm sure. But there are moves currently, and there is research going on around the world and in New Zealand to look at early biomarkers like blood tests that will be able to tell somebody years before they're actually symptomatic whether they're likely to get dementia. And that's very relevant to what we're talking about here, because this is a way of intervening early, knowing earlier and intervening earlier. Now, if we have those things in place, we also need to think about ethics. You know, how do you communicate to somebody that they're likely to get dementia down the line? You know, it requires a very kind of sensitive communication. So these are not easy things. There's a lot of complexities around them, but we are, it's like a perfect storm almost. There are so many advances in dementia care in both medical and social fields that actually we're at a precipice where soon we'll be able to tell whether somebody's likely to get dementia much, much earlier on, and then put in place strategies to then avoid dementia, or delay rather, is a better term.
I suppose as well, with that greater knowledge, especially somewhere like New Zealand, where I suppose, you know, there is a significant chunk of the population has medical insurance. Is there a danger in that people, if they find out that information, will then be put in a tricky situation as regards cover?
You open up a whole can of worms. Vladimir, did you want to come in there?
I'll take one in here.
Yeah.
Biology is not destiny. And I'll give you a specific example, and that is that we looked at several populations, several studies, and then we looked how often does the brains of people who, when they die and their brains are examined, they say, oh, they have Alzheimer's disease. How often have they been demented? Well, we found that in people living in the community, only that among the people who had the pathologic diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, that 2/3 of them were not demented. In other words, the biomarkers are, of course, very sophisticated things, but they do not determine that. And the second point is that genes are important, but But expression and suppression of genes are important too. But this, I mean, you could have a bad gene, but because you have a healthy lifestyle, it doesn't manifest, it doesn't get expressed. Or vice versa. You have a bad gene and you have bad habits. So it'll express itself, not only that one, but others, for example, inflammation and so on. So at all stages of our life, environment and our own actions influence the expression of genes. So I agree with you that one has to think very carefully when you want to investigate, because you may find things that ultimately are irrelevant and in the meantime can inflict a lot of suffering and worry unnecessarily.
You're with Saturday Morning on RNZ National. Susie Ferguson with you, and our guests this hour, Vladimir Hachinsky and Caroline Bartle, talking about dementia. And actually, Caroline, if I can talk to you a little bit about the situation in New Zealand as regards the gaps, the way that we have yet to go in some aspects of dementia care. Where can we make some more progress in Aotearoa?
Okay, so post-diagnostic support is really important, and there has recently been a really excellent review done by Dr. Matthew Croucher and others, I believe, looking at what best practice we can draw from around the world. You know, making sure that people get diagnosed timely is really important for so many reasons, including the fact that if, you know, you diagnose people earlier on, you know, they're more cognitively able to be able to manage the condition as well as be able to access treatments and therapies. So timely access, particularly in rural communities, is a problem here, and equitable access is a problem. And these problems are not dissimilar to other problems around the world. So there's a lot of work going on currently around post-diagnostic support systems. And then also a lot of work, like in our organisation within Ryman and our peers, in terms of how we can evolve aged care so that we can support people that are in the more advanced stages of dementia. And then we've got the whole thing about our carers and how we can support them, because they are our hidden workforce. That it's both them and also the caregivers, and how can we train them effectively, because essentially it's one of the most skilled jobs in the world. And just as Vladimir was saying earlier, you know, when you care for someone, they're more likely to go on and care for someone else. So actually the economics of compassionate care are really fundamentally important. So there's a lot of work going on to train our workforce and make sure that they've got the right skills, because we just don't have enough of them.
What more can be done to give that back up to caregivers, whether they are whānau, as you mentioned, or whether it is in nurses and caregivers in an institution setting? What is it that we don't do yet that we should do?
Well, workforce development around the world is challenging in our sector, because it's very difficult to release staff for long periods of time. We just don't have enough of them. And also because it's such a complex and ever-moving field, dementia care, making sure that we're delivering the right training at the right time in the right way is really important. So in many other countries around the world, we have dementia knowledge and capability standards. We don't have them yet in New Zealand. Like, for example, in the UK, there's a whole module around risk reduction. You know, so if anybody's working in the area of risk reduction, these are the skills that you need to know. I actually sit on the Alzheimer's New Zealand's education board, and we're working to look at how we can introduce those things, because actually if we know what good looks like, we'll be able to not only deliver to that training, but also be able to measure to that as well. So it's really important that we can muster the resource and the energy to really develop this comprehensive framework to support our workforce.
So what would having national knowledge and capability standards and guidelines, what would that actually mean? What change would we see?
Well, it would mean that when somebody is delivering any kind of training program or even defining job descriptions, they would be able to look at what the skills are that people need. Because, you know, dementia awareness training, and I've been in workforce development for all 20 years, and I can tell you that years and years ago, we just delivered dementia awareness and that was it. You know, it was just what the types of dementia, what's the difference between delirium and depression, you know, and there was nothing more than that. But actually, there's so much more you need to know. You need to know how to communicate. You know, you need to be able to understand the challenges that somebody experiences that might cause distress and how you should respond to that. You need to be able to understand end of life care. You need to be able to understand how to work with families. You need to be able to understand how to put support systems in place so that somebody's able to participate in activities. It's incredibly skilled.
Professor Haczynski, to come back to you, when we're looking at holistic brain health, which I guess also has good impacts on other aspects or other conditions that the brain can experience, as well as other diseases that the body can also experience, what sort of things should people be specifically looking at and specifically thinking about to reduce their chance of developing dementia?
Well, it goes back to the ABC, actually. You know, be active, at least move. You don't have to go to the gym. Secondly, see whether you can make one change in your diet. And thirdly, follow the key word for getting good sleep, and that is shut down. First thing is shut down the darn screen. It is bad for you. First of all, it produces blue light, which suppresses melatonin, which has to do with sleep. And if you happen to be reading the news and it's bad news, you may be thinking about it and won't fall asleep. Secondly is shut down the windows. Have a ritual where you get, I'm going to sleep. And thirdly, shut down your mind. You know, if you can practice mindfulness, that's great. So those are the ABC for the individual. But they don't forget that you're part of a community, and interacting with others is not only good for the sort of emotional well-being, but it's actually a preventative for mental problems. Because if you don't talk to someone, you tend to ruminate, and from being anxious, you can get depressed, etc. So there are simple things for the individual. Then also don't forget that the larger picture, and that is, in New Zealand, you're lucky to have certainly a safe environment and a healthy environment, as far as I can tell. The part that needs to be improved is the part about a supportive society. And I don't know enough about you to be critical, but certainly in Canada, that's one of the big challenges. So take it upon yourself to do something, and do it preferably with your partner. And I keep emphasizing, anything you do with someone else, you double the chance of doing it. And begin doing something about the larger environment so that you're living in a healthier society, a safer society, and a more supportive society.
Mm. What about things like brain teasers and word searches and Sudoku? I've seen that these sorts of things are apparently helpful. Are they helpful?
Well, they're helpful if you enjoy them. I mean, they for sure do that. But I don't expect them that because you do them, you'll be better at other things. It's just like music. You know, if you practice the piano, you have the concentration, you have the enjoyment. But don't expect that by playing the piano, you'll be better at the violin. So by all means, doing something that you enjoy, particularly if it demands attention, is good for the brain to maintain it. Or learning a language. And in fact, one of the NHS, that is the National Health Service in Britain, has sort of five rules for brain health. The first one, of course, is connecting with others. The second one is actually physical activity. And the third one is learning. So you can imagine when I was saying going to a walk with a friend, well, start learning about the healthy habits or learn a language. So you get three things in one walk.
That's the five ways of well-being.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Is it ever too late to make the changes?
It's never too late, but the earlier the better.
Yeah, and that's quite significant, for, you know, specifically for our community and the report that was published this year by Alzheimer's Disease International. I think it was, the strapline was, it's never too late. It's never too early, it's never too late. And I think it's important that people take that on board, you know, that even though you may be over 65, and I can't believe that that 65 is old, but it's never too late. You know, even over the age of 65, you can make changes.
There was an American comic, George Burns, who lived to almost 100. And he said when he was in his 90s, if I knew I was going to live this long, I would have taken better care of myself.
Just before you go, what is the place of medication, of drugs in all of this? Because they're pretty few and far between when it comes to dementia.
Well, first of all, there's no treatment per se. The two drugs that are available, they have marginal, if any, effect on cognition. And so the big problems in dementia are not limited to simply cognition. They're limited to behavior, for example. And there are a number of drugs that are effective in helping with behavior. And I think that Caroline would know better than I what they are specifically.
Well, I'd like to say that actually we've got initiatives to reduce what we call antipsychotic drugs in dementia care, and because we like to use what we call non-pharmacological interventions, which are non-medical interventions, because that's our first line defence. Actually, we prefer not to use drugs to support people's distress.